We won't be surprised to know that home invasion and youth crime are in the headlines again. And state Labor governments are trying to get tough on crime. Victoria's Labor government passed what it calls its community safety bill this week, in line with Premier Jacinta Allen's violent crime adult time policy, which now means that offenders who are 14 years old or over could face life sentences. In Queensland, the new Crisafulli Liberal National Government did a similar thing after it was elected last year with its Making Queensland Safer Act. And this week, the Queensland Attorney General responded to a petition with over 113,000 signatories demanding greater powers of self-defence when it comes to home invasion in the form of what's known as a castle law. Now, the government response doesn't read like an intention to pass a castle law and instead refers to the Queensland Law Reform Commission's report on criminal defences, which was also received by the government this week but hasn't yet become public. There have been similar castle law petitions in Victoria and New South Wales. So what is a castle law, and is home invasion, in particular by youth offenders, really on the rise? Dr. Alex Simpson is Associate Professor of Criminology at Macquarie University, and he's been wading through the statistics on that very question. Alex, welcome to Sunday Extra.
Hi, Adrian. Thanks for having me on.
It's a pleasure. Could you explain for us what this violent crime adult time policy that's just been legislated in Victoria means in that state?
Yeah, this is following on the heels of what's happened in Queensland with its own moniker of adult crime, adult time. And it's basically removing detention as last resort for children. It will see more children incarcerated as a result. It seemed to be kind of a tough, more punitive measure deliberately designed as so to combat the perceived rise and increase of youth crime across the state.
And so you said there the perceived rise in increase of youth crime across the state. So is there an increase in youth crime in Victoria?
Well, I think there's definitely been increased media attention on youth crime. And for all of us, the main way in which we have an experience of crime is through the media. So that does really magnify perception and kind of creates an urgent sense that something needs to be done. But yet Australian Bureau of Statistics shows something quite different happening here, in that youth crime is down across all of Australia, indeed across over the last 10 years. So for the most recent statistics of 23-24, so the 10 years prior to that, youth crime was down 28%. We do see some increases within that. For example, robbery increased from 46 per 100,000 up to 75. Weapons offences has slight increases, and assault. But we also see how in their own ways, we measure them in different ways. Like, for example, assault was down 23% across 2009-10. I can keep on giving you the numbers, but it shows that overall youth crime is down. And when we focus on particular crimes, ones which are attached to the media attention, the picture is slightly more complicated, and it certainly doesn't show that sharp uptick, which we might imagine happening given what we read in the media.
Right. So you're really ascribing the community sentiment there, I suppose, to the media coverage more than the actual rates of crime. If the figures are going up modestly per 100,000 of population, doesn't that still mean that there is actually an increase in the number of particular offences?
Well, there has been a drop in overall offences per 100,000. So it's just a question of which crimes we are concerned about. And yes, we do see a moderate increase in certain crimes, and crimes which arguably we are most concerned with, such as assault, weapons offences and robbery. But this modest increase probably and arguably would not necessarily lead to or sustain the argument for there being, in inverted commas, a crisis here in youth crime. And after all, when we start to see this kind of media and public and political attention towards this issue, then we lead into kind of police crackdowns and mandates to kind of solve this, in inverted commas, problem. And therefore, we are likely to see an increase as a consequence of it. So when we're looking at crime statistics, we're only really seeing the administration here of crime, the crimes that have been recorded. There are many crimes, specifically around sexual assault, for example, which aren't recorded in an accurate way. But when we start to see these crackdowns, we're going to see an increase in the recording of them because there's more interest in them. So really, it's not a question, arguably, whether crime is going up or down, but whether it's going up in a way which necessitates this more punitive shift. And I would kind of argue strongly that it doesn't, especially in the consequence of the overall drop.
How easy is it, Alex, to compare crime rates, say, between state and state or state and territory in Australia?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think the short answer is notoriously difficult. Okay. If you kind of think of all the states and territories as their own separate countries, because they all have their own legal statutes, their understanding and defining of crime. And whilst the most serious ones have that kind of common sense similarity towards them, for example, assault, they do differ in subtle and really key ways. For example, they might not always include the intent to do harm or that threat. Rather, they might need that physical, impact. So they do vary from state to state, even for the most obvious ones. But also the counting metrics differ. So how we record crime stats is arguably more important as to what crime is taking place in the first place and how they're coded and measured. And the threshold for robbery, for example, will differ across state and state. So the reason why I'm referring to the most recent stats, which comes back from 23-24, some of your listeners might think, well, that's not very recent at all. But that's as recent as we get through the ABS statistics books. It tends to take about a year for them to kind of comb through all the individual states and territories kind of statistic agencies and really come up with something which is as comparable as we can get here in Australia.
On Sunday Extra, we're speaking with Dr. Alex Simpson, Associate Professor of Criminology at Macquarie University. And Alex wrote in The Conversation this week, the piece is Australia in a Youth Crime Crisis. Here's what the numbers say. And we've been hearing about some of those numbers. Alex, one number that can't be disputed is the more than 113,000 Queenslanders who put their name to a petition for what's called a castle law. Could you tell us what a castle law is and why it's called that?
Many of your listeners will be unsurprised to hear that it comes from English common law, as so much of our laws here in Australia, particularly kind of archaic. So this is referred to the 19th century common law origins for, you know, excuse me for gendered language here, for a man's house is his castle and each man's home is his safest refuge. So this is kind of where it comes from. It was originally kind of curiously about protection, not necessarily from criminals or invading gangs, but rather from the crown and trying to have a sanctity of space around home. It's often kind of compared to, and kind of perhaps incorrectly so, the US adoption of Stand Your Ground. But fundamentally, it's all about how much force can we expect to use in the consequence of a home invasion or someone breaking and entering. And that our laws serve to kind of protect us here around what is considered to be reasonable. But the castle law is about trying to increase that in different ways.
Yeah, so the Queensland Attorney General, in response to that petition, referred to the existing defence of dwelling. So what is the current rule for what people can and can't do if someone invades or enters their house with an intent to commit a violent act? And how would a castle law change it?
Again, that is an easy question. That's a very complicated answer. As always with these things, because of the word reasonable, you know, that can be incorporated in many different ways. So we can all defend ourselves by using reasonable force. And of course, this means a kind of a split second kind of almost pre-reflective response to really what is, let's face it, a terrifying situation. But there are laws, and this is what you're referring to here about the Attorney General in Queensland saying there are laws designed to protect all of us across the country, let alone in Queensland here. But it is that debate around reasonable. But then when we look at the cases where people defending their home, property, or the people in the home with them have gone to trial, there's only been three major high-profile cases in the last decade. And two of those three were acquitted. So really kind of raises the question as to kind of, is there a deficit in the current laws? Are the current laws not working? And do we need to have this increased force? Which does lead to increased risk in terms of the consequences of using force, kind of simply kind of upping the ante in the heat of that moment and consequences there. It also kind of leads to concerns around kind of community safety, leads towards vigilantism, but also questions around kind of other aspects around race, for example, how we perceive threat when codified through this lens. So, and also it's not important to forget that the police advise us to phone them, to not have a weapon in the home and immediately contact the police. So there's a lot of grey area here, but fundamentally, along with what the Attorney General was saying, we are all protected in the home to use reasonable force. And that does tend to fall down in the favour of the people protecting the property, not the invader.
Yeah, so even on the current laws, things seem to be falling in favour of the person whose home it is. While we're talking about the effectiveness of laws, Alex, is there much evidence that adult crime, adult time laws are effective in terms of reducing youth offending and reoffending?
Yeah, I mean, I think the important message is not just the fact that they're not effective, but they actually conversely often contribute towards higher rates of future offending, kind of increase the risk of re-offending, re-arrest and re-incarceration. This is broadly true for all who we incarcerated, not just youths, but children have the longest lives ahead of them. So there is a greater risk of not just future offending, but the onset of kind of more harmful, more sustained future criminal careers, which is really deeply problematic. And the Queen's and Family Child Commission kind of showed that in its own report, kind of estimating between 84 and 96 of young people released from its own youth detention centres reoffend within 12 months. So really incarceration makes things far worse than other counteractive measures. It's not the fact that we do nothing, it's not that incarceration is our only option, but rather evidence shows that kind of community-based rehabilitation and restorative justice practices, family engagement, education or mental health support are all kind of more effective than incarceration. But yet, as we go towards these election cycles, we see politicians reaching for these sound bites, adult time, adult crime, which seem intuitively to make sense. But yet, when we dig down into what actually works, there's a very kind of counteractive practice happening here.
Well, Alex, it's been fascinating discussing and dissecting the numbers and the policies with you. Thanks very much for joining us on Sunday Extra.
You're more than welcome. Thanks for having me.
That's Alex Simpson, Associate Professor of Criminology at Macquarie University. And this week he wrote the piece in The Conversation, Is Australia in a Youth Crime Crisis? Here's what the numbers say.
Find more great ABC RN stories that take you beyond the headlines on the ABC Listen app.